Thank you, Brother John, and good morning, brothers and sisters. I read this book once by a Christian author named Josh McDowell, and it was a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And basically, it was a whole bunch of evidence for the Christian faith. He went through archaeological evidence, went through examples of Bible prophecy, and then a large portion of the book was taken up by personal testimonies by different Christians who had become Christian, and this was their story. And one of the testimonies was the testimony of Josh McDowell himself. And in that testimony, he talked about how when he was in college, he met a group of Christians, and he saw that they were different from anyone else he'd known. And this is what he says. One important thing I noticed was that they seemed to have a happiness, a state of mind not dependent on circumstances. They appeared to possess an inner, constant source of joy. They were disgustingly happy. They had something I didn't have. Now that quote has always really scared me, because I'm not disgustingly happy. I don't have this sort of inner constant source of joy that always makes me happy all the time. Sometimes I feel sad. Sometimes I feel angry or blasé or melancholy or tired or bored or hurt and crabby or lots of different emotions. I'm not always happy, despite the fact that, as far as I know, I'm a Christian and I did read his entire book. So if you know anyone that knows the secret for being disgustingly happy all the time, and I did read Josh McDowell's entire book and he didn't give it away, so I'm still looking. But if you know anyone like that, I would be interested in talking to them, because it does sound like they might have something that I don't have. But something I can say is that whatever religion or philosophy they have that's like this, it's not Bible-based. Because I have read the Bible, and there are a lot of very righteous people in the Bible who are not disgustingly happy. And if you were paying attention at all to that opening reading I had of Job chapter 3, you probably noticed that Job was not disgustingly happy. In fact, he was about as depressed as you can possibly get. That's why I wanted that read. Every time I read that chapter, I go, wow, he's not happy. It's probably about as far from happy as you could possibly get. He wishes he was dead. He wishes he had never been born. He does not want to be here. And if you wanted to join a group based on, you know, whether they're happy or not, and you read Job chapter 3, you might go, I don't want to be anywhere near this. Whatever Job's doing, it sounds like it's the wrong thing to be doing, because Job does not sound happy. And some people would say that's actually what's going on here. So it doesn't mean, you know, Christianity has something wrong with it. Job has something wrong with him. Because if he was actually behaving righteously, then he would be happy. His problem is that he's not doing it right. Real Christians are happy all the time. And, you know, Job, he just has got it wrong. Job must be a sinner. He's not following the game plan, and that's why he's unhappy. And if you do it properly, then you wouldn't be unhappy like that. There are people who would say that. People like Job's three friends. And they do say that extensively in the book of Job. We're not going to read the entire book this morning. But Job's three friends were wrong. Just as a brief synopsis of what happens in the book of Job, I'm sure you're all mostly aware of this, but just to get you thinking about it again. In the book of Job, we have the story of a very righteous man named Job, who God deliberately hurt so that he could test his righteousness. Job lost everything that he had, including his health. And at the moment when he's saying the words in Job chapter 3, he's sitting in a pile of ashes, picking away at his boils with a potsherd. He's in bad, bad shape. And so Job's three friends come along to try and help him out. And they point out that, Job, if you're in bad shape like this, this must be because you are doing something wrong, because God does good things to good people and bad things to bad people. But it wasn't actually Job who was wrong. It was his three friends. God wasn't punishing Job for his sins. Job hadn't sinned, and yet God was still hurting him. And we need to make sure we don't make the same mistake that Job's three friends did. If someone is unhappy, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a sinner. If I'm unhappy, that doesn't necessarily mean that I am doing something wrong or have done something wrong. Even very righteous people can be unhappy. Even Job was unhappy. But you might say, you know, Job, that's perhaps not the best example in the world. Like, that's the Old Testament, and, you know, he's kind of not really connected to anyone else. Some people think it's kind of maybe a little exaggerated, more play than actual history. And like Josh McDowell, he was talking about Christians. So we're Christians, things are a little bit different now. Job was a long time ago. But thing is Job is not the only unhappy person in the Bible. Let me say I told you that there was someone who was even more righteous than Job, someone who is far more Christian than Job, someone who perhaps was not just a side note of the entire Bible, but was the entire focus of it, and yet he was also unhappy. Because if we read in Matthew 26, verses 36 and 37, we can read about Jesus Christ and how Jesus himself was very, very unhappy at a certain time. I'm going to start reading from Matthew 26, verses 36, 37, and 38. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." Jesus went to the Garden of Gethsemane and prayed, not because he was happy, not because he had this inner constant source of joy that was keeping him going, but because he was sad, because this was really hard, because he was in pain. If you're a baptized Christadelphian and you're trying to follow the example of Jesus Christ as best as you possibly can, and you're still unhappy, that's okay. It's possible to be unhappy and still be a Christadelphian. Jesus was unhappy, despite being Jesus Christ. If you're facing really hard challenges, if you're feeling overwhelmed and stressed out and unhappy, don't go, "Oh, I must be a bad Christian." Don't go, "These people over there seem happy and I'm miserable, so I must have everything wrong." Don't go, "Things are hard, so there must be something wrong with me." Because Jesus was not bad. There wasn't something wrong with him, and he still had to deal with really hard challenges. If you're looking for a religion that promises constant happiness, don't be a follower of Jesus Christ, because Jesus didn't ever promise that. You might want to talk to Josh McDowell, but don't talk to Jesus. In fact, you know how Jesus described discipleship? Matthew 16, verse 24. Matthew 16, verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." The moment that Jesus is using to define what it means to be a disciple is not the moment when he triumphantly entered Jerusalem, when everyone was cheering. It's not the moment when people are crowding around him to be healed. It's not the moment when he's walking across water. It's the moment when he is carrying his cross to Golgotha so that he can die there. Jesus is saying that following him as his disciple means being willing to take up our own cross and struggle to our own deaths, like he did. And so, be careful telling someone that if they're unhappy, they must have something wrong. Because Jesus himself was unhappy. He himself had to carry his cross to Golgotha, and he was not wrong. Because the reason we do this is not because we enjoy being unhappy. Why would Jesus be a Christian? Why is anyone a Christian if it's all just about unhappiness? Well, clearly it's not. It's not just about unhappiness. If you read the story of Job, it doesn't just end in Job chapter 3. That would be a very depressing book. As our presider brought out, the story of Job goes on for quite a bit about how unhappy Job is, and goes on for quite a bit about why bad things sometimes still happen to good people. But it ends with Job receiving twice as much as he started off with. It ends with Job being happy. But the whole story does not feature Job being unhappy. Christianity does promise joy, but it doesn't promise constant joy. But we still have to go through the unhappiness then. It would be a lot easier if it promised constant joy. It's easy to be happy. It's hard to be unhappy. So what can you do when you are unhappy, when you are like Jesus or like Job and facing really hard times? Well, one thing you can try, which we see both Jesus and Job trying, is reaching out to your friends for help. Sometimes what one person can't do, two people can. In Ecclesiastes, a very wise man says, two are better than one because they have good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Sometimes when things are really hard, it's nice to have somebody to help you up. But as a word of warning, both Jesus and Job tried to rely on their friends and it didn't go so well. So sometimes friends can help and sometimes they can't. Based on what I've seen, friends tend to help a lot better when you have a good idea of how they can help you. And if you don't know how they can help you, often they don't know either. So for instance, if you need to move a piano and you ask your friends for help and you tell them we all need to like push or pull or get a one of those rolly things and move this piano, it's probably gonna work out pretty well. I just recently helped my sister move and they had a piano and we got a whole bunch of us together and we lifted it onto one of those rolly things and rolled it in. And what I definitely couldn't have done on my own and my sister couldn't have done on our own, we all worked together and we got it done. Moving pianos is something where friends help a lot. But say, for instance, someone really close to you dies. You can ask your friends for help, but your friends probably aren't going to be able to bring them back from the dead. And if you tell them, my mom died, can you please help me? They don't always know what to do. In fact, you might not know what they can do. And that doesn't mean that there aren't things that they can do that can help. If something like that happens, you can try to help them plan this funeral, or sometimes it's helpful if they buy you dinner, or maybe sit and listen and talk to you as you remember this person who died. But people can't just bring people back to life. Friends can't always fix all your problems. And it does help a lot if you give people clear directions on what they should do to try and help you. If you have a good idea of how someone can help and you communicate that to them, then usually things go much more smoothly than when you don't. But sometimes that doesn't even work. You know, Jesus gave his friends very clear directions that they were supposed to stay awake and pray that they enter not into temptation, and they all fell asleep on him anyway. Friends are humans too. They're not perfect. But it does work a lot better if you're asking your friends for help, if you help them know what they can do to help. And if you're that friend and you're on the other position, trying to figure out what you can actually do to help. If you're able to read minds, this is an excellent opportunity to try that. If you can't read minds, I'm unfortunately not so good at it. Communication usually helps a lot in those sorts of situations. And sometimes they don't know either, and the best you can do is the best you can do. Try and be a good listener, sympathetic, do nice things. But you can't work miracles. And I mean, sometimes there is something you can do, though. I mean, if you see someone with this big nail sticking out of their forehead, and they're complaining about how they have this throbbing headache, and, you know, some dull pain in their head that won't go away, and, you know, their clothes keep getting weird rips and tears in them, you might want to, like, pull out the nail. But most of the time, it's not that easy. Most of the time, people have real problems, and they're making them really unhappy, but you can't just fix them. And if you're trying to help, it can make you super unhappy, too. Another little pro tip, if you're unhappy because someone else is making you unhappy because, you know, some horrible thing has happened and you need to vent, it's okay to need to vent your pain as well. But don't vent your pain back to the person who's hurting more than you are. Treat pain like noxious gas. Vent it away from the source. Little tip, makes things go much better. So anyway, sometimes you ask your friends for help and they don't help or they can't help. But that doesn't mean that you have no other options. Both Job and Jesus tried to lean on their friends and that didn't work. So both of them leaned on someone who wasn't going to give out under them and someone who could help. And that person was God. And it was God who eventually helped both Job and Jesus through their unhappiness. Now, that doesn't mean that God will always solve your problems immediately. I wish he did, but he doesn't. Jesus asked God to take away his cup from him. He asked God to make it so that he didn't have to die on the cross, and God said no. Jesus still had to die on the cross. But God helped him through it. He did send an angel to strengthen him while he was in the garden, but he didn't take away the problem. Jesus still had to go through it. But in the long run, Jesus' problems were solved. He was resurrected. He is now reigning as Lord of heaven and earth. Things did get better, but it took a while. And I can assure you that if you wait long enough, eventually God will solve your problems, whatever your problems are. How can I know this? Because I know what the plan of God is. In Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 14, as well as a few other places in the Bible, we see what God's plan is. Let me read that for you. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. As long as you don't have a problem with that plan, eventually all your problems will be solved, because that is what will be filling the earth, the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. That is how Paul can say in Romans 8, verse 28, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. Because Paul also knows what God's plan is, that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. And as long as you are good with that plan, as long as you are part of that plan and love God, then all things will eventually work towards that. So in the long run, in the very long run, things will work out. Problems will be solved, even if things are hard or difficult now. And what that can give us is hope. Hope is something I found is the real key to getting through unhappiness. Because no matter how bad things are right now, no matter how much pain you're in, you need hope to keep going. Because if you don't have hope, there's no reason to go. But if you have hope, you keep walking forward. It doesn't take away your pain, but it does give you a reason to keep staying alive. And that is what we can see when we look at the life of Job sustained him. In Job 13, verse 15, he says, though he slay me, I will hope in him. And even better, when we're looking at Jesus in Hebrews 12, verse 2, which I'll admit is a verse I come back to a lot when I'm going through hard times. Hebrews 12, verse 2. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. It's not talking about the joy that Jesus had all the time. We already saw in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus didn't have joy. He was unhappy. But he did have joy to look forward to. That's what hope is about. Hope is not about having joy now. It's about having joy in the future and being willing to keep going, to keep living, to keep on walking or swimming or breathing to get there, because there is joy in the future. Hope sustains you. And that is what we see in the lives of Job and in the life of Jesus. They were sustained through their unhappiness by their hope. And the thing is that's actually a wonderful blessing that we all have, that we have hope that things will get better. If you don't believe in God, if you don't believe that something is in charge of the life, the universe, and everything, then you can't have that sense of hope. If you read people talking about global warming, say, who don't believe in a God, they truly believe that if human beings mess up, we'll make the planet uninhabitable and everyone will die and that will be it. Because they don't trust that there's a better plan for the world, that somebody is in charge. If you don't have the knowledge of an omnipotent God, you can't have that sense of hope that eventually things will get better. But we do. And it's a wonderful blessing that we've been given, knowing that there is a God in charge of the universe, that whatever may happen, no matter how bad things may seem, it's all part of his plan. And that is something that can keep us going, no matter what sort of unhappiness and pain and sorrow and grief we're going through. it's not a constant internal source of joy, but it is a constant external source of hope. It's not within us, but it's within God that we can have hope. And it will keep us going, even when things are very difficult. And so this morning, we're gathered here to remember a man who was not always happy. We're here to remember a time when actually he was in great joy. The breaking of bread is a remembrance of the Last Supper, and he does say, "With desire I have desired to eat this bread and drink this cup with you." But it was a time just preceding, a time of great sorrow, when he was about to go to his death. Jesus was a man who did have great joys, but he was also a man who suffered a lot of pain, a lot of sleepless nights, and a lot of unhappiness, and finally died in a horrible and painful way. But he did that out of choice. He did that because he had a hope that where he was going was worth it all. That his death was horrible and painful, but it would be worth it. That there was a hope of eternal joy behind that. And he went through it, and he chose it, and it did work out for good. And we are his disciples. We have chosen, in the same way, to live a life that won't always be happy. A life that, by the world's standards, might be far less successful than the lives of people who choose to focus on their own happiness and their own joy and try and seek as much joy and happiness and fun and pleasure as they can get out of this world as they possibly can. That's not what our goal as followers of Jesus Christ is. And it means that in this life, we probably won't be as happy as some other people. But it gives us a hope of eternal joy in the life to come, a hope that whatever we go through in this life, even if it's hard and painful and lonely and a struggle, it will be worth it in the end. And I want to close with the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." And that is the hope that we have.